Accession number 30255.
Douglas Ducky, row 3.
Well, not a lot, really. I mean, I seem to have lived on the sidelines of everything, you know, like an observer almost. I used to trot across to the depot, and I had an office which I shared with the CO sitting opposite him and another lieutenant we had there. And at that time, a wren called Ross, a rather handsome big girl, I never really discovered what she did, actually, but she was always around. And
what was your job?
The job was to service the boats with whatever was required to get it dispatched on our lorries by train or whatever, to control the stocks, to go round and control the chaps and make sure the cleaning, you know, finding a chap cleaning out a petrol tank, you know, smoking and all this sort of stuff that had to be stopped. Almost what you would imagine anyway that the Coastal Forces Depot would do, we did. And
how did you feel about the fact that you'd been assigned there rather than
a bit disappointed, quite honestly. Yes, a bit disappointed, but everything moved so fast, you didn't have a lot of time. And I was in contact with a lot of people still that I've been with, so I was quite happy with that. This is where I'm coming to, as I said to you, what was a little difficult at times. We took over, in addition to the Lymington Houses and Totten, we took over Pyewell Airfield in the New Forest, largely as a dump for stores, and we were getting to a time in the war when there was more coming through than was actually necessary, so there were V8 engines and all sorts of things on this airfield. We upset some of the New Foresters who were used to grazing their ponies and all the rest of it on this, and we eventually had to get hold of one or two German Shepherd dogs to patrol the perimeter and that. Parwell House again was a lovely place with brick gardens of camellias and a lovely beehive shaped butter house, and it was all remarkably strange. But
that was the house in the New Forest,
yes,
that you took over. Mm. Yeah.
But a lot of this, here I'm getting in a muddle. I can't remember, and nobody can help me. At some time, I went to Exbury. Now Exbury was HMS Mastodon, and was a home of the Rothschild family. And why I was there or what I did there, I can't remember. All I do know for sure is that wandering around the gardens one day with some others, we met...
put your glasses. I think, weren't they down?
Yeah, well done, yes. You're quicker than I am. We met a young man, and we said hello, and he said hello, and he said, "I'm Leopold Rothschild," and we said, "Good for you," and he said, "I'm going in the Navy," and we said, "Yeah, and I suppose you get an instant commission with your family." "No, I won't," he said. "They wrote to Admiral, and they wrote back and said, you get in the Navy like everybody else and take your chances." Years later, I wasn't sure, and I still don't know what I was doing there. Years later, I wrote to Exbury, and I got a reply from Edmund de Rothschild. Well, you can. Do you want me to? Would if I read it?
Why don't you read it? Yeah. So who this is? This is from
Exbury, the Rothschild's home, Edmund de Rothschild, and he's very old when he writes this. This is the letter was written about 10 years ago. "Dear Mr. Tucky, thank you for your letter of 25th of March. The young man you saw was my brother Leopold, who was 11 years younger than me. He did his national service as an ordinary seaman on HMS Kenya, so he didn't get his commission. I'm glad you came to Exbury for a short time. It was properly then called HMS Mastodon and had a very unusual role, being the centrepiece for the planning of D-Day and Walcheren, as some 15 miles to the east, Eisenhower had his headquarters, 15 miles to the west, Patton had his headquarters, and 15 miles to the north was Montgomery. If you want any further information, I suggest you write to Mrs. Marion Loveland, so on and so forth, who is Secretary of the Exbury Veterans Association, which you may care to join, which I haven't done. And as I say, I'm losing quite a lot of this Totten stuff because it became so regular, it doesn't stand out. It became my daily job, if you understand.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily remember
I don't necessarily remember the details very much.
We could just kind of pick through it and see which bits.
I think I mentioned to you, and this is.
Sorry, we'll just stop you. I'll just change the reel briefly.
Yes. I personally found my early days at Totten perhaps not quite so enjoyable as I did later on. The personnel I was with were not so congenial to me, or nothing wrong with them probably. But later on, Cornter was succeeded by Lieutenant Commander Bussey, who had been engineer officer to Peter Scott on the steam gunboat flotilla, and he and the young lieutenant who was with him, we all got on splendidly, you know, as a team, and had a very enjoyable time. Going back a bit, I think I should mention that one of the difficulties with under the previous regime was that there was a grey area of demarcation between what was civilian and what was naval. And I had some difficulty myself over the V8 engines that I've mentioned, because a firm called Nash Concessionaires were asked to participate in running Pyrewell under a managing director called Rossington, and I was sometimes asked to sign papers relating to the bringing to produce, that is, bringing to destruction and final disposal of V8 engines, which in practice were in fact passing over to the civilian side and Nash Concessionaires, and with this I wasn't entirely happy. I was also taken to the Angel Hotel in Lymington occasionally and lunched, and I was rather young to be lunched excessively, because it was thought I might be able to get additional stokers from RM Barracks Portsmouth to work on the airfield, and I'm afraid my assumption is that had I been able to and it had happened, they would have been charged as civilian personnel in the accounts of Nash Concessionaires.
So I don't quite understand that last bit. So how would that?
In other words, a submission would have been made for wages for civilian staff when in fact the labour had been performed by naval ratings who hadn't to be paid at all.
I see.
It became very much routine. In fact, I living on the Anchor Inn was a dubious blessing. Whilst it was pleasant in some ways, it was very, very busy. In fact, at night, the place was awash and often ran out of beer. And at 11 o'clock at night, being there with the friends who ran it and their daughter, I could hardly refrain from giving them a hand in clearing up. And clearing up the bar at 11 o'clock at night was something you could really do without. On the other hand, people used to come in and out. I mean, all sorts of officers came down and joined me down there for a time, and it was quite social. But I met a chap called Edwards in Southampton, and he was acting as warden of the Toc H at Bassett at the top end of Southampton. And I spoke to my CEO and I said, really, you know, it's all very well having beer on tap, but it's a bit unpleasant at times. So I said, I'd like to go and live at Toc H, you know, and come in every day. Which
so
I
what's Toc H?
Toc H was founded, it was a First World War thing, an organisation for the troops, really, a Christian one, founded by Tubby Clayton, chaplain of the First World War. And they had sort of hostels and things for young men up and down the country, an organisation, a do-gooding organisation online with many others. And Toc H at Bassett was quite comfortable, and Charles Edwards was quite interesting. He and I became great friends. He had been to South Africa, and he actually was a qualified chemist and had been chemist for a small manufacturing chemist in Southampton, and they had made toiletries and other things in competition with the bigger boys. A fairly difficult task because, of course, toiletries depend so much on high cost advertising, and even if your product is good, I'm afraid it's a field where presentation is all. Anyways, he'd been out to train in the Air Force and sent to South Africa to Pretoria. Now, of course, in South Africa, all the South, it was a volunteer army, all the English and those Afrikaners who were in favour of the British were in the north fighting at Tobruk and places. All the Afrikaners in the army left behind tended to be those of a fairly Nazi disposition, or certainly friendly to Germany, and members of the Ossifer Bruntag, which the Orange Brotherhood, which one of these chaps at Loughborough with me had been engaged in investigating. At any rate, Charles had a nervous breakdown whilst he was there, and had remained over for a long time working as a chemist somehow or other in his uniform. People got forgotten, you know. You know, odd people in the war. Now we talk about, you know, the Falklands. There were, 80 chaps here or 50 chaps there. There were millions of chaps. Odd blokes got lost. I mean, my friend John Slade, who wrote History of the Merchant Service, he came ashore from a sinking in South America, and there he remained for ages. You know, he saw the consul and he gave him some money, but there was no way quickly of getting him home, so there he remained in South America. I'm digressing.
That's okay.
At any rate, Charles stayed on as a chemist for some time there under a Dr. Pearl, who was one of the chaps who recommended all this masticating of food, you know, masticate your food 32 times and so on. In the end, the treatment of the RAF trainees over there was so bad that they came on under Afrikaner instructors. They came on parade one day and they just refused to go off, and they flew in an Air Vice Marshal from England to take over because it was an impossible situation. Anyway, that was Charles Edwards, and so I lived at Toc H there for some time, and things went on and on and on, and girlfriends, I don't think we'll bring into this.
Well, maybe we could talk a bit more about what your job consisted of, because you sort of talk very, very quickly about some of the different things, but on a daily basis, what kind of task would you be doing on a daily basis?
Well, communicating with the other coastal forces depots like Hornet and so on up and down as to what they required, making sure that we had it, making sure that the consignments were coming in, making sure that where repairs and cleaning was necessary, inspecting all that.
So you'd actually be going out. Where was everything kept?
I'll show.
You can describe and show me.
Yes. I am now showing Kathy a picture of the depot so she has some idea. That was the depot. Yeah.
Okay, so it's quite a big long building, isn't it?
Yes, right. It was quite extensive then.
Right.
And the Anchor Inn was somewhere down there in the front.
So you were just across the road.
Yes, that's right.
And so within that sort of big long building, you'd have sort of an area for one thing and an area for another thing.
That's right, yes. I mean, it was so familiar to me, it's difficult to remember to describe. I mean, There were miles and miles of trunking and all sorts of things, and pretty old-fashioned it was. And a curious thing is, going forward a little bit, and this really is curious, we were there for some time. That building has now become a heritage centre. But nobody at the Heritage Centre had ever heard that there'd been a Coastal Forces depot there. Now, this I find almost extraordinary because, yeah, okay, the ratings came from a long way away, but a lot of the women and chaps came from up the road. It mystifies me, as if we never were.
How strange.
And opposite is a tide mill, which is very historic, and people get mixed up. We call ourselves Ealingville, but most people think of the tide mill. And when the invasion of Europe was going to take place, I think I had to go over and warn the chap at the tide mill that despite his 500 years of history, we were expecting some kind of desperate counterattack. And we felt that they might try some landing, but if so, we were going to blow his mill up, you see, which didn't exactly turn him on a lot. I'm trying to think of what was interesting about all this.
Well, it's not even necessarily what's interesting, because it's just... it's just trying to sort of map what people were doing. So just trying to understand what people's roles were. So,
yes.
You know, trying to understand the kind of things that you were supplying, how the systems worked. That's all interesting too.
Yes. I think that as D-Day approached, of course, the whole area became so congested with service people and Americans of all kinds and types and vehicles and boats and so on. It was quite beyond belief. I mean, this book I've got here, somewhere here, Beauty River Goes to War, shows even places, the every creek was full of ships.
Yeah.
And the whole area. What I'm coming to, how it affected us, we were somewhat secondary in priority often, because obviously the first thing was that the MTB would go into Lowestoft or wherever and pick up what it wanted, and that store would be the priority. So our role was secondary in keeping the main stores supplying the individual depots at every harbour or base that Coastal Forces had.
So let me understand the way the system worked. So an individual boat would turn up at a depot around the country.
Yes, that's right.
And would
be serviced from within its own stocks.
Yes, and meanwhile your depot was supplying.
We're
the
wholesaler.
Country.
The wholesaler. Yes, and as a result of that, I think that we took second place sometimes in transport, because although there were railway lines in the area, most of our materials used to come in by lorry, as I recollect it, because I think the railway lines were so full of a continual flow of major transporters of tanks and all the rest of it. And
So let me just understand how it works. So it where were stocks coming in from for you, from individual companies?
Oh, individual companies up and down the country, yes. Plessy and different manufacturers, yes. That's
and how did you then transport, how did you, were you transporting
By lorry chiefly, yes. There were all sorts of arrangements. Very rarely boats came up. They could come up to Ealing, but that isn't how it was done, oddly enough. Don't ask me always why. But that was how it was done.
And did you you were talking to people on the base, on the other bases around the country all the time, presumably,
yes,
on the phone?
Yes, that's right. Yes, and
I was just wondering, were there any parts that were, you know, were there any parts that were always quite difficult to get hold of, or do you remember anything like that?
It was a fairly smooth operation, as I recollect it. I think the best overview of the coastal forces that happened, that was written immediately after the war, was Peter Scott's Battle of the Narrow Seas.
Yeah.
But of course, this sort of stuff was rarely mentioned because, you know, people weren't going to be terribly excited about that a petrol tank was sent by lorry or something, you know, this really didn't.
But see, that's why it's quite interesting for us, because it's exactly the kind of stuff that
doesn't get talked about.
So your kind of history is actually...
That's why I tell you, it is surprising that things can vanish without trace. That heritage thing, I couldn't believe it. It's quite recently I went down and found this out. I used to get tales of all kinds. Of course, the Navy always had. Peter Scott was obviously a brilliant man, but he was so highly connected. Bussy told me he found him rather supercilious to deal with. I mean, if you have immediate entree to Princess Margaret and all this sort of stuff, you know, I suppose it does affect the way that you behave. I think things went pretty smoothly from then on. We operated these bases, and there were a lot of it was just storage, of course. Finding stores for everything.
Yeah, it must have been difficult. You must have at times have had huge amounts of.
Well, that's why we got an airfield. Yes, huge amounts there were. We occasionally used to go out on MTBs, you know, on various to be shown. Shown what we needed to know. I mean, to familiarise ourselves with how parts were used and all the rest of it.
Yes, because you must have had to understand the way it actually fitted together and.
Oh, that's, and also the jargon. Even you today have asked me once or twice, well, you know, what does that mean? I'm not used to it.
Yeah. Can you remember any of the jargon?
I think I would have to pause for too long. It's going to get wearisome if I try to remember the words. I don't know if there is a good book about naval jargon, but there really should be.
That's okay, just if anything comes back along the way.
But my life there seemed to peter out. I think, actually, the war in Europe, I suppose it was D-Day came, and as you could read in this book, Beauty Goes, The River Goes to War, suddenly all these great flotillas and armadas of ships disappeared, and the Americans disappeared, and eventually I went and spent a short time at an RM camp at Stock Heath near Havant, just generally looking after trainees and things of that kind. But that was really the running down at the end of it.
So let's just talk about the D-Day, because I sidetracked you again. But
yeah.
So did you have a sense of why there was this build-up of troops?
Oh yes. I mean, it was absolutely colossal. And the choking of the roads and so on, it had to be seen to be believed. I mean, some of the stuff was so big. I remember outside this Tock H place at Bassett on one occasion, I walked out and this big American tank transporter was moving down, and it had to turn right instead of going straight down into the city, right towards the west of Southampton to Shirley and places. And he misjudged it, and he was so powerful, there were cars along, and he just sliced the sides of the cars off all the way down. And at Christmas, prior to D-Day, when the build-up started, I mean, it was really amusing. There were so many Americans there all over Southampton Common. And on Christmas Eve, I think, they were given a bottle and a half of cognac per out of three men in the morning. And by lunchtime, practically the whole American army there were tight, quite frankly. And Christmas Eve, late afternoon, this extraordinary spectacle of women shopping last minute for turkeys if they could find them, and picking up presents with leering and rather drunken Americans wandering about between them. And Southampton, of course, don't forget the bombing there is something. I mean, the centre of Southampton had practically gone, large areas of it. And they still had trams then, and very curious, at night they built tracks over the common and dispersed them onto the common. You know, like some Emmett thing, these things would bounce about on temporary tracks into the forest for the night. The D-Day operation, and of course we were very busy at that time, and then it suddenly subsided.
And how did you feel about the fact that you weren't taking part?
Well, yes, you get so used to being told. I think that's what made life easy. It made it more tiresome at times. I think it made it easier than life out of the services, because you didn't have to ask, what am I going to do? You were told what you were going to do. The other chaps with me ended up on all sorts of odd assignments. Mobile naval air bases, some of them went to, which landed at various points in the Far East. My friend Brian went to Singapore, to Sembawang. Funny accounts of the Americans and the amount of stuff they felt was absolutely essential for sustenance of life when they landed, as opposed to what our chaps needed. And of course the Americans were fairly hardly treated, because they were paid more. People made them sure they paid more than we did. I know the taxi fare to Tottenham from Southampton was twice as much for an American as it was for me. But obviously, being in a place like Tottenham, we had more communication, having such a large civilian staff, than would have been normal. One of the more unpleasant duties I had was when our lorry ran over and killed a young boy quite close to the depot, and I had to go up and represent the depot at a funeral. We used to have parties and dances and things in the village, and it was relatively easy. Can we stop for a moment?
Yes, of course we can.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe if we can start, just, you were going to talk about the move to the new
place. Yes, that's right.
Where,
yes,
it was Stock.
Stockheath.
And when was this?
This must have been 45, I suppose, yes.
So this is coming up towards the end of the war?
Yes. After the excitements of D-Day and the tremendous build-up, when the whole of the south of England was dedicated to one project and men in their millions were moving, there was an anticlimax, and soon afterwards the fighting had disappeared into Europe, the troops had been landed, the great flotillas of boats had been dispersed, and the anticlimax was in a sense slightly depressing. because everybody had worked towards one great objective. That objective was virtually secured, and now what next? In fact, the existence of the Coastal Force Depot was under question, whether the two depots, the other depot, as I remember, was at Luton of all peculiar places, whether this sort of depot was any longer needed. At any rate, it came to an end, and I was transferred temporarily to a naval camp at Stockheath near Havant.
So the depot was actually shut down?
Yes.
Right, okay.
And